friend that abandoned the JCPOA in 2018, so that's the party to take the first step if it ever wishes to go back, as claimed by President Biden. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has asserted that the Islam Republic has had enough of lip service. Tehran is now awaiting action by Washington, which means the removal of all sanctions reimposed on the Islam Republic under the Trump administration.
The fate of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal still remains uncertain. The United States says Iran should first come back to full compliance with the accord. Tehran, however, argues that it was Washington that walked away from the international accord, and hence it should first fulfill all its obligations, including the lifting of sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Now China has once again called on the U.S. to return to the deal, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, saying it is the only proper way to resolve the deadlock over the issue.
China always believes that the U.S. return to the JCPOA is the only way to resolve the deadlock in the Iran nuclear issue. All parties should feel the urgency to work together to implement the consensus reached during the Foreign Ministers' Conference on the Iran nuclear issue in last December, and urge the U.S. side to return to the JCPOA unconditionally as soon as possible while lifting all sanctions against Iran.
Meanwhile, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani said the new U.S. administration needs to act swiftly to make up for Washington's past mistakes and return to the rule of law. Rouhani stressed that the Iranian nation will never bow to U.S. bullying. On Wednesday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said what Tehran wants to see from the other parties to the nuclear deal is action, not words.
من میخوام امروز فقط همین یک کلمه رو بگم بگم ما حرف و وعده خوب خیلی شنیدیم که در عمل اون حرفها و وعده‌ها نقض شده و ضدش عمل شده حرف فایده نداره وعده فایده نداره این دفعه فقط عمل
The new U.S. President Joe Biden has signaled a willingness to rejoin the JCPOA, but his administration has conditioned the move on Tehran's resumption of its commitments. Tehran has repeatedly said it will accept no precondition for the return of the United States to the agreement. Iran recently announced that it has decided to suspend the snap inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Officials said the move would be in line with the Iranian parliament's recent legislation called the Strategic Action Plan to counter sanctions. Tehran, however, noted that the decision does not mean ending all IAEA inspections of its nuclear facilities. In reaction, the UN nuclear watchdog said its director, Rafael Mariano Grossi, will travel to Iran to discuss the issue. After the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018, Iran waited for a year and gave leeway to the European signatories to the deal to make up for the U.S. pullout. They, however, failed to live up to their commitments, prompting Tehran to scale back on its commitments under the accord. However, Iran has time and again said that their measures are fully reversible upon full compliance by the remaining signatories. Now questions arise as whether the Biden administration will follow the path of its predecessor against Iran or try to rectify the Trump-era policy against Iran, which has been described as a failed approach even by some of Washington's closest allies.
Okay, that was a report by Matthew Fireman. Let me invite our guests to this show. We'll have Executive Director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, Daniel McAdams, in Lake Jackson, Texas. And also author of The Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, Gareth Porter, who is joining us out of Arlington, Virginia. Good to have both of you on the show, gentlemen. Let's go to Daniel. China and Russia have echoed Iran's stance as to the U.S. return to the accord. What would you advise the Biden administration do, if you could? And let's not forget the fact that Iran is still under so-called most severe sanctions that have been in place by the Trump administration, known as the Maximum Pressure Campaign.
Well, President Biden's administration has had a full month now to revise its Trump's failed policy. Maximum pressure has been a maximum failure. There has not been much action. And in fact, you know, I think they're sort of tied into a corner right now. You have some strong statements by Anthony Blinken, who talks about the need for Iran to return to the deal first. Whereas, of course, as your report pointed out, as everyone knows, it was President Trump of the United States that pulled out of the deal. The net result of this whole thing really is the U.S. is losing stature as a good actor in the world stage. If you can't keep your deals, if you can't keep your bargains, then nobody will deal with you in the future. So this is a problem for the Biden administration. There doesn't seem, they don't seem to be moving in the right direction.
Garrett, on Wednesday, Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei said that what Tehran wants from Washington is, I'm quoting him, action, not words, over the nuclear deal. And we have heard many nice words and promises, which in practice have been broken, and even opposite actions have been taken. Now, does Iran have good reasons to distrust the U.S. intentions and policies?
I think it's a fair statement to make that Iran does have good reason to distrust American statements about this entire issue. And really, one has to go back some years, if not decades, and understand the origins of this situation, which is that the U.S. government, going back not just to the Trump administration or even to the Obama administration, but previous to that, had a strategy of really trying to coerce Iran to bow down to U.S. demands with regard to its nuclear program. And this was, in fact, a fundamental sort of principle of operation of the U.S. in international affairs during and after the Cold War, which was to establish a hierarchy of power, a clear hierarchy in which the United States would be calling the shots, and smaller, weaker states would have to buckle under to the U.S. diktat. And so I think what we've seen in recent years is a continuation of that situation, where the United States expected that it could somehow continue to impose its will on Iran. And the JCPOA was certainly to a great extent a departure from that, because at the beginning, let's face it, the United States believed that it had the wherewithal to force Iran to essentially give up its nuclear program, to have no enrichment. That was the demand that President Obama was making as late as 2012. And when the negotiations began, he soon began to realize that he wasn't going to be able to enforce that. And so the process of making concessions to Iran and its rights began. And I think the final result bears that out, without going into more detail. But I think we have to recognize that the Biden administration now is continuing this practice, this belief, if you will, that the United States can and must impose its will on Iran by pressure, by having leverage on Iran. Mm-hmm. And that means that it must somehow rely on the Trump administration's sanctions against mm-hmm. Iran, which are the strongest sanctions the United States has ever brought to bear against Iran. And that is why I think it's clear the Trump administration is not ready to go back to the JCPOA at this point and wants to continue to try to exercise that leverage.
Right. Now, Daniel, the Biden administration's public stance is that it will only lift sanctions on Iran if the country reduces the activity of its civilian program to the JCPOA limits. But it was the U.S. that violated the agreement, and Tehran wants Washington to act first. The U.S. took the first step out. Now it should take the first step in. Now, is Iran asking for too much?
Well, I think they're both publicly making strong stances and seemingly intractable. But I think we've seen some indications. There have been kind of a flurry of diplomacy. There have been the involvement of third-party actors this past week. Merkel spoke to Rouhani, I think it was yesterday. And there have been a couple of similar conversations. Remember, we are on the cusp of the Munich International Security Conference, where President Biden is supposed to speak tomorrow, scheduled to speak tomorrow. So if he, in fact, remembers where he is when he's speaking or what he's talking about, there is some possibility that he might make mention of the JCPOA in some way. But in your report, you quoted Khamenei as talking about what we need to see action. But he also said, if we see action from the other side, we will take action as well. So I think there's an indication of some ability to move. People have talked about some kind of a phased return to the JCPOA with the EU as kind of a broker. So I think there are more possibilities, there are more things on the table than it may seem when you simply listen to the rhetoric of both sides.
Now, Gareth, the issue of distrust is a very serious one as far as Iran is concerned, and you know very well about Iran. You have written books about it. And the U.S. signed this multilateral UN-backed deal with Iran and then simply left it after a short while. Then it even threatened the remaining signatories not to stick to their commitments as per the deal. So how can Iran trust that the same wouldn't happen again?
Well, I think Iran must trust the United States to be the United States. I think that's the problem, that it must have a realistic appraisal of the way the United States operates and an understanding of the psychological and political origins of the strategies and tactics that the United States practices diplomatically in regard to smaller states, states that do not have the same degree of power that the United States has. And at one time, as you know very well, and as your viewers know very well, the United States relied on the threat of military force as its primary source of leverage or pressure against Iran. And now, it's very clear the United States recognizes that is not going to work. It is no longer possible to rely on the threat of war against Iran because Iran has too much power to resist and to essentially impose real serious costs on the United States and its allies in the region. So now they are relying entirely on their economic sanctions and specifically the ability to deny Iran the ability to trade, to sell its oil, which is the mainstay of its national budget. And so I think it's much more fundamental here. I'm not nearly as optimistic as I think Dan has suggested he is at this point, that there is a lot of room here for negotiation. I think there's going to have to be a much more fundamental shift in the nature of thinking about Iran on the part of the Biden administration in order to get somewhere in the zone of real negotiation. And I must say that the people who have now moved into the primary positions of policymaking in the Biden administration are not people who've impressed me as really very flexible in their thinking. So I'm relatively pessimistic at this point about an early resolution or even a beginning of resolution of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, Daniel, before taking office, President Biden pledged to work with Iran to restore the JCPOA, but so far his administration has failed to act. What do you think is the reason for this failure?
Well, Biden ran as the anti-Trump, and now certainly on foreign policy, but now that he's in office, he is basically, continuing the worst of Trump's policies, and in terms of continued sanctions against Venezuela, continued dedication to regime change in Syria, whereas I think Trump lost a little bit of stomach for these Middle East adventures, even with a few of his infractions. But he is continuing this idea of a sanctions regime, and I think Gareth is right. And by the way, I'm just trying to sound optimistic. I'm not that optimistic. But I think, as Gareth said, there are so many people that have gone into the administration who spent these last 4 years in very provocative positions with regard to Syria, with regard to regime change, with regard to Iran, that it does make you wonder. So many people from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy have gone into the administration and other various AIPAC-oriented think tanks that you can't really be too optimistic, even as I try to be. But, trying to read the tea leaves as to what might be happening, you do notice some sort of neocon chatter. And I mean, I hate to sort of rely on this, but they're even dragging out old Reza Pahlavi. You know, once again, they're dusting him off to warn, don't you dare go back into the JCPOA. Biden, it's so dangerous, and this sort of thing. So you're seeing neocons, you're seeing a lot of U.S. representatives, and of course, the war and war threatening is the lifeblood of Washington. But they're coming out and threatening Biden. And I'm just wondering, are they nervous and how nervous are they? And that might not be an indication that Biden is about to perhaps take some moves in the positive direction.
Now, let me ask Gareth for some more explanation on the point that he's not so optimistic regarding what President Biden promised during the electoral campaign. So is it only the people around him, Gareth, or what?
Well, I think it's primarily the people that he's named to be Secretary of State and National Security Advisor who are people who are really hardliners on issues that relate to to this problem. And I feel that they are not inclined in any near-term view to be flexible. They're not simply sort of voicing threats that they're hoping Iran will now suddenly respond to with their own sort of making concessions so that they can then shift into a different mode. I feel like that they're taking a stand that is more fundamental here. And it's extremely dangerous. Let's be clear about this. I think it is dangerous. But it does reflect a set of expectations, a set of values. And on the other side of the picture, or part of this picture, is the domestic political structure of the United States, which is so strongly dominated by right-wing extremist views on Iran. And I think that Biden himself and his advisors, his key national security officials, are very sensitive to that domestic political context as well. So it's an additional factor that leads me to feel relatively pessimistic about short-term sort of progress in the direction of diplomatic resolution.
Okay. Now, Daniel, let's take a look at the EU in the middle of all of this and the European signatories to the nuclear deal. They have always insisted that the deal must be preserved, but in action they have failed to fulfill their commitments under that accord. They have been accusing even Iran of not sticking to it. And how do you see the European side of the deal's behavior and role?
Well, the Europeans have made a decision to de facto pull out of the deal themselves after the U.S. did, and after people like John Bolton exerted pressure on them to do so. They haven't shown a lot of backbone or a lot of spine when it comes to this, but that really shouldn't be shocking because we're talking about the EU here, especially EU foreign policy, which tends to be Washington's lapdog. But I don't think that doesn't mean that they have a role to play here. I don't think that they wanted the deal to go sour, unlike President Trump did. I think they want to be in the deal. Certainly the Germans had experienced the positive effects of the deal with the renewal of trade relations with Iran and a lot of money changing hands. So I think they want it to go forward. I think they have a role to play. I think they can play a role of some sort of slow walking back the sanctions. But I think at the end of the day, the Iranians are holding a lot more cards than Washington right now, even though, of course, there's a disparity in military power. The Iranians have announced that they are, on, I think, February 23rd, going to pull out of the voluntary additional protocols, which allow snap inspections from the IAEA. They have so many moves that they can make and continue to make with, I think, a pretty good guess that Washington is not about to go to war as they do these things. There are several more moves they can make. There really aren't a lot of more moves that Washington can make at this point. So I think the Iranians are actually in pretty good position vis-a-vis Washington on this.
Okay. Now, Garrett, Daniel talked about the EU's role in this. Now, what about the role of Israel in this process?
The Israelis are playing the same role that they have in the past, or at least attempting to play that role, of putting pressure on the White House to hew to essentially Israeli interests by essentially not going ahead with any serious negotiations that would result in making concessions to Iran on their nuclear program. That hasn't changed at all. If anything, the Israeli government has hardened its posture in recent days, and we see, you know, the prime minister essentially naming somebody to deal with the United States and other countries on this issue who knows nothing about it, and who is simply going to be following Netanyahu's own orders almost day by day. But I don't think that Israel has the same degree of clout that it did, some years ago. I think it's been shown that they cannot control U.S. policy, that U.S. Policy toward Iran is effectively driven by domestic U.S. interests or interests that whatever administration in power has in regard to the issue. Now, that was not particularly true of the Trump administration, where you had special, you obviously had special relationship between Trump and the Israelis, which had a monetary character because of his reliance on pro-Israeli financiers to, mm-hmm. to fund his election campaigns. But I think now we have a situation where Israel does not have the kind of clout that it had under Trump, and even less than it had, I think, during the Obama administration.
Okay. On that note, we come to the end of this debate show. Thanking my guests in this debate, we had Executive Director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity, Daniel McAdams from Lake Jackson, Texas, and author of The Manufacturer Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, Gareth Porter from Arlington, Virginia.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. As always, it is a genuine honor to have you with us on Back to Reality. Only from IRIB English Radio, I am your humble host, Zainab. And in the studio with me, I have two special guests. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me here. I'm Sayyid Wahid Alawi.
Thank you for being with us. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. I'm Razia.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you
so much. Today, we're going to be talking about... So I think it's really important for us to discuss today the necessity and the method of reconnecting the youth. I think we would be third generation youth, right? Well, not us, but we'd be counting a third generation youth from the day the Islamic Revolution took place and was victorious, right? It has a third generation already.
We're the second generation.
Yeah, we're all second generations, but the Islamic Revolution is looking upon a third generation now, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And
our children.
Yeah, exactly. Y'all's children. Do you guys find it at all necessary, first of all, to reconnect the third generation to the Islamic Revolution? And if you do, how?
I would take a step back, first of all, and take the... Because when you're talking about Islamic Revolution, is nothing more than the pure Islamic teachings.
Or that's how it's set off to be.
That's how exactly it's set off to be. So I would, as a mother of a child... And as a teacher, as a researcher...
As an auntie?
Yeah. I would focus my attention on self-purification, first of all. And then on increasing my level of knowledge, whether it's in the realm of theology, whether it's in the realm of... especially the teachings of the Quran... I think we have taken a very big distance from, you know, even recitation of the Quran and
absolutely,
contemplation.
Absolutely.
We are the religious sector of the society, but how much do we read, contemplate, and act upon the verses of the Noble Quran?
Hmm.
So if I want my child to be the followers... you know, to pave the path of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, there is nothing better than a practical role model that I can provide for my child, which is myself as a parent.
Mm.
So I don't have to like look complicated formula of where I have to go. No, just be a decent human being. Don't lie.
Don't cheat. Don't slander. Don't backbite. Don't
exactly.
Cuss,
don't oppress.
Exactly.
Don't lower. Don't raise your voice. These seemingly trivial points that we have to take into consideration into our lives. This is true Islamic revolution. It's nothing more.
They're not trivial though.
Yes,
seemingly trivial. You know,
they're very tough. That's what we call jihadul akbar.
Mm.
All
Which
of those things that you said,
the greater jihad. The greater struggle against yourself.
Yes, against
Absolutely.
Your nafs, your ego.
So you
the
have
carnal
to
soul. I can connect to that. that if you want to show that these people are good role models, look at me, my child, the new generation. Look at me, look at your mother. We're trying to do our best. We're trying to be good role models for you in all the different dimensions that a human being has. And by doing so, I think children will automatically be connected to the Prophet, first of all, to the Prophets, to the Imams, and later on, all those scholars, which one of them was Ayatollah Khomeini, all of those scholars, they will be connected to them.
Instead of focusing on the past and the revolution, which is actually, when you go back to the core, it is Islam, I think let's look at the future horizons, which is, you know, we are, as Muslims, we have the belief that there will a time will come when we will have a leader, a ma'asum, an infallible, and, you know, that the believers will inherit the earth and whatever in that which belongs to the earth. I am having that kind of perspective towards my next generation.
So you're waiting for paradise to come?
It's paradise on earth. With the reappearance, yes, I am waiting for that paradise.
I'm saying let's do this paradise now. That was one of the purposes of the revolution, that we shouldn't wait till the ma'asum comes. If we elevate ourselves, if we elevate our society, Imam Mahdi would come himself.
So
let's have paradise now, not for the future.
We don't have a paradise now.
Don't go on credit, go on cash.
Yeah, we don't have a cash paradise right now, but I'm saying my perspective, I'm looking, my horizons are to bring up a generation to pave the way for the reappearance of our Ma'asum Imam. Mm. So this is the perspective that I have in mind. Going back through the pages of history, history repeats. What I'm just trying to say is that I don't want to make life so complicated and so philosophical and so hard to grasp and understand. The simple, Islam is the religion of simplicity.
Right.
Islam is a religion of balance and moderation. And,
right.
You know, at whatever position or status, whatever standpoint you have, whether it's in the private realm of your, you know, life, in your family or in the society, to be, to carry out your responsibility that has been laid on your shoulder, this will lead to a kind of generation that will be inqilabi or revolutionary.
Mm.
This is it. It's nothing so complicated. I think this is what Imam Khomeini wanted.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
To a great extent, I feel that it's not the revolution that made the people, it was the people that made the revolution.
Exactly.
And looking back at the history of the revolution, people and elites such as Imam Khomeini, Ayatollah Mutahhari, the martyrs, the Shahid Beheshti, Shahid Bahona, Shahid Rajai, the martyrs of the 8 year and post-war. All of those people were those who created those cornerstones, the groundworks for, fast forward 41 years later from the revolution, Iran, right? And if it's any, if there is an ounce of spirituality, if there is an ounce of truth-seeking, if there is an ounce of drive and motivation for perfection left within this soil, it's because of the legacy those people have left behind.
Right?
What was their legacy?
Their legacy was Islam, simple as it was. I mean, I'm thinking the martyrs, the Islamic, the war, they call it Iran-Iraq war, but it was actually Iran against the rest of the world kind of war, happened 2 years after the revolution. So the martyrs were not the product of the revolution. The martyrs, in fact, were a product of the ways their parents raised them to be, right?
Right.
So we can't necessarily say that, oh, we have to connect people or the generation with the revolution. The revolution within itself was important because it was based on this ideology, and that ideology was Islamic, and those people were the products of Islam. And that's how it gets its title.
Exactly.
So at the end of the day, yeah, I actually agree with you guys. I don't do that very often, but yeah.
One thing that is very, you know, because we, the young generation, it's really, we don't like to go back to history and like to read over history. It's nice, but it's like a little boring, and not so many people would actually do that. Looking at our contemporary role models, you know, I said I want to make everything to seem very simple.
Right.
A very good role model for at our time is Shahid Soleimani, Martyr Soleimani.
Right.
What made him Martyr Soleimani?
Oh, you can forget going to
He was
now.
The son of the revolution.
Right.
He was the product of this revolution. What made him so special?
I would personally say he produced the revolution, but sure, okay.
Exactly. What
I would
what
like
was
to say
him?
That he gave self-sacrifice. He gave everything that he had himself for the people.
Okay, self-sacrifice.
Without asking for anything back.
In return,
that
yeah.
made him, yeah,
selfless,
exactly.
self-sacrifice.
Right.
I would go
it was
for
selfless.
His purity of intention.
Mm,
yeah,
definitely.
That is, of course, would
seriously.
Have been.
I mean, this is the core of Islam, that whatever you want to do, you do it for the sake of, you know, the pleasure of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yeah, but you can have pure of intention and go to your work daily.
Exactly.
But he had pure
everything
of intention and went to the battlefield.
But he happened to be a soldier, you know? That was the difference. Anyone can acquire
That's
the position of someone as General Qasim Soleimani if they have the
selfless.
Qualities he had in that magnitude.
Mm, right.
You know what I mean? And they can produce revolutions.
So it's not only purity of intention. You have to, he was a soldier too. And he gave everything on the battlefield. He
Each
went
one of
and
us
put
is
his
a soldier,
life on the
I
fire.
Believe.
Yes, but again, we're talking about different levels. Magnitude, that Sister Zainab said. So when I have pure of intention and I'm going to the radio station, it's very different when you have pure of intention and going and risking your life and making your children orphans.
Sometimes
it's very different.
Sometimes the ink
the
of the writer is as precious as the blood of a martyr.
Right. Right.
So
as precious, more precious, more precious.
Exactly. So it's not necessary. As you know, it's as I said, Islam is not.
But then
the
you
religion
have to compare Shahid Soleimani with Ayatollah Khamenei. Not Shahid Soleimani with us.
Why not?
Because he is the scholar. He is the one who is the master teacher. He's the
it
one
is
who
the ink
takes
of the scholar that
towards those
motivates
exactly.
a martyr to spill his blood. But coming
exactly.
back to our
exactly.
question regarding reconnecting the third generation or the youth to the Islamic revolution, I think it is safe to say that we've concluded that it's just a matter of terminology. We say Islamic revolution as a synonymously with Islam itself because that was the ideology on which Imam Khomeini founded this entire movement. It wasn't something based on some random old guy from Khomeini's whim thinking that, okay, I want to go down in history. Let's topple the old regime and make people kill each other because my name has to last. It's not what he did.
But there were many ideologies involved.
Yeah, absolutely. Naturally. And, I mean, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam wanted to establish an Islamic government and everybody suddenly was an expert in how to run a peninsula. But if we agree on the fact that Imam Khomeini, again, back to purity of intention, he did this out of the pure belief that it is necessary at this point of time and era for there to be an Islamic Shi'i government in this world for people to turn to as a beacon of hope when Palestine is being bombarded on a minutely basis.
Right.
When that other country in Africa, that other country in Southeast Asia, that other country in South America, that other country in Europe, you know?
Right.
And to reconnect the third generation with something like that is simple, as you say, but it's hard, as you say. Simple as in it's not complicated. It's not nuclear physics. Be a good person in accordance with Islam and your children will look up to you and they'll be good Muslims. But it is really hard.
totally.
God knows how hard it is.
Major struggle.
So with that said, one can only hope. At the end, we hope for the universal revolution that will be established by the hands of the son of Fatima. And we hope that we can create the groundwork for that revolution, as so many before us have created the revolution that inspired us more to await the last Hajjah of Allah. That's all the time we have for today's episode of Back to Reality. Thank you so very much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The World with Reporters.
the latest available data suggests only 4.8% of EU citizens have so far been vaccinated against COVID-19. Frustration levels are growing because it is not yet clear when people living in the 27-nation bloc can expect to receive the jab.
Of course, everybody needs to speed up. All the countries, France, Belgium, Germany, it's all hanging. We're all hanging around and just waiting.
For example, in France, for my grandparents, it's quite hard to get some appointments to have a dose.
We should speed up a little more and start vaccination a lot. Vaccinate people a lot.
In hindsight, it turned out a bad decision that the EU was responsible because the overall administration is so complex it would have been easier to have this set up on a national level.
That widely held opinion is being rejected by the head of the European Commission.
With the purchasing power of 27, we were able to agree on this enormous volume I've just described, 2.3 billion doses.
So where are these doses? Experts say the reason the UK and US are way ahead of the EU on vaccination is because the European Commission was too slow to sign contracts with producers, and approval to use the jabs is also a sluggish process.
Mass vaccination centres like this one in Brussels are popping up right across the European Union. On the face of it, that sounds like a great thing. The problem is they are practically empty due to vaccine supply issues.
The European Commission has just launched a plan designed to detect variants of the disease earlier and share this information across the EU. The problem is that mutations are allowed to form when large numbers of people are not vaccinated.
We are ready to go one step further and to propose an emergency authorization of vaccines at EU level with shared liability among us if there's a decision by the European leaders to move in this direction.
The economic consequences for the EU of this slow vaccines rollout are almost immeasurable. The political consequences for the project might prove fatal, according to some analysts. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The family of Dubai's billionaire ruler, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, has once again made headlines. Back in 2018, the Sheikh's daughter, Sheikha Latifa, posted a video of herself just before making an abortive attempt to flee Dubai.
All my father cares about is his reputation. He will kill people to protect his own reputation. He only cares about himself and his ego. So this video could save my life.
In a new video published by the BBC, Latifa says on the last leg of her escape to India that her boat was intercepted and she was beaten, injected with a tranquilizer, and dragged back to Dubai.
I'm a hostage, and this villa has been converted into a jail. All the windows are barred shut. I can't open any window. I've been by myself, solitary confinement. No access to medical help. No trial, no charge, nothing.
But the Sheikh has denied the charges against him, describing his daughter's return to Dubai as a successful rescue operation. He insists she is now safe and in perfect health, but has yet to provide any evidence. Latifa's story is considered to be the latest in a series of scandals the Sheikh is grappling with. In March 2020, the UK's High Court found Sheikh Maktoum guilty of waging a campaign of fear and intimidation against Princess Haya, the youngest of Sheikh's six wives, and abducting her two adult daughters, Princess Latifa and Princess Shamsa, who was snatched off the streets of the city of Cambridge in England. It is said that Tony Blair's Labour government dropped a criminal inquiry into Shamsa's abduction as a diplomatic favour to the Sheikh, and it seems those favours keep coming as the UK is still reluctant to condemn the billionaire.
I think it is concerning. We always raise human rights issues with all of our partners, including the UAE. There's no particular British locus in this case, but we are concerned by this.
But the statement appears to be far from the truth, as London heavily supports a deadly military campaign waged by the UAE and Saudi Arabia on Yemen. The country, the United Nations says, is facing the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. The new video of Sheikha Latifa has escalated international pressure on the UAE. Amnesty International expressed concern about Latifa's well-being, saying her detention amounts to torture. It also added that this case brings into light the other human rights violations for which the UAE has repeatedly come under fire. The UN also said it will discuss the matter with the UAE, noting that the international body could launch a thorough investigation into Latifa's fate.
Following the bitterly disputed 2020 election campaign, top pollster Gallup has found that support for third parties is at its highest point ever in the United States. 62% of people agree that a third party is needed because Democrats and Republicans, quote, do such a poor job representing the American people. Another polling record was also recorded. The number of Americans who identify as an independent is now at 50%.
And everybody's tired of it. Everybody is fed up with the hypocrisy and ineffectiveness of the Democrats in the terms that they claim to want to be effective. I think they're actually very effective in what they're actually doing. And the Republicans, of course, you know, they have one program, which is tax cuts for the rich.
Ex-President Donald Trump, who remains banned from top U.S. social media, issued a rare statement which attacked top Republican leadership. That's being interpreted as a sign that he may stay within the mainstream and try to make so-called Trumpism the undisputed platform of the Republican Party. However, there is much speculation that Trump will start a new third party. Polls say a Trump-led third party would attract not just two-thirds of Republicans, but also 30% of independents and even 15% of Democrats. The party would push Republicans into third place, ushering in a new era of multi-party plurality and ending what is probably the world's oldest political duopoly.
Certainly those people are out there ready for the picking for a third party that they perceive as A, fighting for things that are important to their daily lives, and B, treating them with respect and not treating them as, you know, you're a racist and fascist and you know, sexist and whatever.
Trump won in 2016 by running as a so-called outsider candidate, and while he is unemployed 4 years later, rejection of the two mainstream parties is now the majority sentiment. The most popular third parties currently in the U.S. are the Libertarians, who are associated with a strong demand for individualism, the Greens, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and the Alliance Party, a coalition for independence. Those parties combined for under 2% of the 2020 presidential vote. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Alleged favoritism at the heart of the British government, committed by Dominic Cummings, the former top aide to Prime Minister Boris Johnson. UK High Court documents suggest he played an instrumental role in awarding a lucrative contract to a polling firm run by his friends in March last year. There was no formal contract, prior advertisement, or competitive tender process. After only a shake of hands, Public First, a company run by two former colleagues of Cummings and Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove, was paid £540,000 out of the public purse in March last year to research Britain's understanding of the coronavirus and the government's messaging around the pandemic. What started as an informal contract was only formalized retrospectively in June 5 and publicized a week later.
Yet another black mark against the government in its whole handling of the COVID-19 crisis and other situations in which there seem to have been shortcuts made, handing out very large contracts, very valuable contracts indeed, to friends and even family of Conservative ministers or donors to the Conservative Party.
The story was first revealed by The Guardian and Open Democracy in July last year, but was brushed aside as nonsense. In a written statement to the UK High Court, which he did not attend, Cummings admitted he was friends with the company's directors, but denied he recommended them for that reason. He claimed there had been no time to follow usual procurement rules, and the work was crucial to the government's early pandemic response. But the Good Law Project, the not-for-profit campaign group that has brought the judicial review of the contract, disagrees, saying money paid to associates on a handshake and formalized later is unlawful.
Quite frankly, it's not acceptable that there has to be a robust system in place which ensures that all contracts are awarded to companies on the basis of their performance and not on the basis of who they know.
The judge in the case is yet to fix a date for a ruling, but the Good Law Project say they are determined that the truth should see the light of day. Although the government is desperate to keep this and similar cases under wraps for their considerable public importance. Saeed Pourreza, London.
EU finance ministers have concluded 2 days of talks relating to the 27 country bloc's dire economic situation resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic.
It has been a particular challenge for young women and men, but also those who are employed in contact-intensive parts of our economies.
One such person is Simon Ledoux, who worked in the hospitality industry in Brussels. He feels abandoned by the state since losing his job.
I feel very depressed. I'm looking for a job, but I didn't find. And my friends, like me, didn't find job.
The social crisis in the EU continues to deepen. Richer member states are being urged to support poorer ones. Within the EU, social rights campaigners say solidarity is now needed like never before in the bloc's history, because of huge disparities among member states in terms of their ability to cope and recover. The European Commission warns a record number of businesses will go under when governments start easing financial aid programmes. The Commission claims firms that were not viable prior to the crisis will be impacted most. Only 6 EU nations have so far submitted draft plans to draw down money from a €750 billion coronavirus recovery fund.
I call on the remaining countries to ratify the own resources decision quickly so that the Commission can start its borrowing program under the Next Generation EU.
Illegal US sanctions against Iran preventing EU businesses from trading with the Islamic Republic show how the dollar is too dominant over the euro. Eurozone finance ministers have been encouraged to strengthen the currency's position on the international stage.
Recent episodes where the dollar was used as a policy tool reminded us that this is not good from a European perspective.
Economists warn the biggest threat to the Eurozone economy right now is the EU's dysfunctional COVID-19 vaccination strategy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After months of discussion and some rough debates, members of the French Parliament have voted a new law, officially called the Law on Principles of the Republic. French authorities say they want to strengthen the respect of equality, fraternity and liberty, but the opposition denounces, as it was called first, the Law on Separatism. They sound the alarm on the stigmatization of the Muslim community.
Aujourd'hui, de plus en plus.
More and more children do not go to the same schools because of the social origin of their parents. That's school separatism. Without saying it, this law concerns only our fellow Muslim citizens and creates a debate on identity rather than on social problems. During weeks, this debate has been a festival of discrimination towards Muslims.
French Interior Minister Darmanin already said that mosques will be closely monitored. Law experts say that this text can be interpreted in different ways, which could lead to arbitrary decisions like the closure of watchdog associations defending the rights of Muslims. Opposition members in the parliament blame the government for not being concerned about the real social problems of the population.
Yes, there is a separatism in this country, a separatism in school and in the French territory. This bill does not speak about it. Our children, depending on which school they go to, do not have the same chances. The public school is weakened.
The opposition group in the French parliament also criticizes the actual French government for seducing far-right voters, as the new French president will be elected in only a year. What is more important, security issues or social welfare?
On a vécu deux ans.
We had 2 years of social agitation with a yellow vest movement and a movement against the retirement law. The poverty and social inequality are exploding in France. But no, they debate on the headscarf.
The reaction of the Muslim community is taking form, but slowly and in a dispersed order. Hundreds demonstrated in Paris, and hundreds of religious leaders and human rights associations asked members of parliament in a public letter not to vote this law on separatism. The law has been adopted by a majority in the French parliament, but Muslims and human rights defenders already promised to continue the protest. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Turkish president vowed that the cross-border military operations that Turkish military is conducting against PKK will continue, as he confirmed Ankara's willingness to expand areas of operations from which threats against Turkey are coming, assuring that the death of 13 Turkish citizens who lost their lives in the Gara attack will strengthen the government's determination to eliminate terrorist groups.
Northern Iraq's Gara province has now been made secure as a result of a 4-day military operation. We will stay in the areas that we have made safe in a bid to avoid similar attacks. Gara was a troubled region. It is taken now, and the problem is gone.
Turkish Defense Minister, along with Interior Minister, met with opposition figures Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu and Meral Akşener separately and explained in details the military operation that was conducted in the region. The two ministers also briefed the parliament on the circumstances of the operation and the martyrdom of 13 Turkish citizens on the hands of PKK. Analysts say the meetings and parliament session were in preparation to draft a resolution to grant the Turkish army the permission to hold wide-range cross-border operation in Sinjar and other areas in northern Iraq.
The war between Turkey and the PKK has been going on for decades. However, I think this time a decision is being made to eliminate the group's terrorists wherever they are. The operation will include Sinjar and Kandil areas. I think all political parties will agree on launching a wider cross-border operation, despite knowing that such a decision will be met with opposition from European countries and, of course, Turkey's NATO ally, the United States.
Turkey accused the U.S. of siding with terrorists. Turkish president said the U.S. statement concerning the death of 13 Turkish citizens is considered, quote, a joke. Other Turkish politicians and political parties also condemned it, saying the U.S. exposed its cooperation with PKK in such a statement. It seems that, unlike Turkish expectations, the new U.S. administration, like its predecessors, will continue to support the Kurdish groups. Many expect the two NATO allies go into another round of tensions. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
February 2011. Emboldened by what was then hailed as the Arab Spring, people took to the streets in Bahrain. The crackdown that followed was brutal. Hospitals overflowed with the dead and injured, and the prisons filled up. On the 10th anniversary of the pro-democracy movement, the European Center for Democracy and Human Rights held a conference. According to the speakers, the situation in Bahrain is worse now than before 2011, with hundreds of journalists, human rights defenders, and opposition figures still behind bars. The US and the UK have military bases in Bahrain. Human rights organizations say both are complicit in the monarchy's rights abuses by refusing to exert the influence they obviously have over the monarchy.
Bahrain is a political ally of the West. It's not some other, you know, this country that there is no kind of form of leverage or control over. In fact, the strength of US and British leverage on the regimes is so strong that it actually, I would say, coerce some of these regimes into entering the normalization deal with Israel that was perceived by, you know, across the board in Bahrain, you know, pro and anti-government people as the final act of betrayal.
One aspect of Bahrain's repressive tactics has received international attention: torture and sexual abuse used in prisons. And the UK's complicity is irrefutable. It trained Bahrain's police force, which carries out the torture, and the Special Investigations Unit, which continues to fail the victims. Some are on death row after giving false confessions under duress, and others live on with the horror playing before their eyes every day. We spoke to one of the victims.
It wasn't a prison, it was a morgue. You had no right to say you were innocent. If you did, they would start